Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. And it's finally Wednesday once again, which brings two things. One, assured, that's JR Jackson who joins us now. How's it going, JR?
What's up? I'm gonna do my best Rick Strom impression. How about that NCAA tournament? How about those Trojans from Southern California? On to the Sweet 16, absolutely destroyed Kansas. That's Kansas's worst ass whooping that they've had in the tournament ever. I'm just gonna say, I'm just gonna point it out. Hey, I don't represent
worst they've been beat since that tornado. I don't know. I don't know any. For all I know, you're making up all of that. I have no ability to discern if any of that's true or real.
Well, it is.
I could guess at the sport considering what month it is, but that's about it, really. Anyway, glad that you're here. And JR, we are going to need you to bring it, and not just in the sports world, because the other thing that comes on Wednesdays is big news, and we don't have it.
I just gave you the biggest news, bro. What did we started with big news? The Southern California Trojans.
If one of those players used a racial slur on Twitch, I'd talk about it, but that's about it, really. Unfortunately, in this case, they've all done their racial slurs offline, so I got nothing to do with that. Anyway, no, but so look, we've got some very interesting news. We've got the future of the filibuster. We're going to continue to talk about that. We've got this amazing Meghan McCain video. Oh my God, it's so good. But we're going to have a little bit of a debate about whether she's trolling us or not. Oh. And we got a lot of other stories too. Some updates on gun violence, on the vaccine. And actually, to that point, we're going to be having a talk about something maybe bordering on a bit controversial. And in advance of that talk, I want to let you know about a poll that's up right now that you can go out there and take part in. It will give you the results a little bit later on the show. It is available at tyt.com/polls/vaccination-plan. Why are we putting dashes anywhere else for these? That's not a good call. Vaccination isn't good. Anyway, tyt.com/polls/vaccination-plan. How are you getting your vaccine? So have you already been vaccinated? Are you patiently waiting your turn? Or are you actively pursuing loopholes? Wow. So we're gonna be talking about those loopholes, and we're gonna see how many of you are interested in that and can figure out that URL. So that'll be fun.
Yeah, that's the one I don't get to participate in, right?
I don't know.
Well, about the vaccines and circling back, because yeah, I don't, you know, nothing. It's okay. I'm gonna keep my thoughts to myself.
Okay. Well, interesting. I'm very curious to see what people have to say about that.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you everybody for being here. Please like the stream and you can share it as well so that people know that we're live. And as we go through, you can send us comments, tweets, concerns, all of that, and we will respond as we go. I see one person is greeting Wednesday in the now traditional way. This is Starry-Eyed Dragon who sent in a super chat saying, JR, I have hot tamales for the news today. Because you're supposed to greet Wednesday mornings with candy, apparently.
Well, there is a new Starburst jelly bean that's wild berry, and it is off the chain, I must say. It's lovely. It's right over there. I was eating it late last night, and you don't want to start your morning with candy. Who does that? That's crazy.
I know, that's crazy. Yeah, I didn't have some of those little Easter candies, the little eggs that are like crunchy. Those are so good. What is up with them?
Crunchy. We're crunchy. Anyway,
they're like hard chocolate eggs, kind of, that have like an eggshell. It's like a little bird egg.
Like Cadbury? Cadbury cream?
No. Maybe Cadbury. Anyway, I'll go.
Oh, get I know the bird ones you're talking about.
They're called like shimmer eggs or something. Anyway, they're very good. And definitely what I should be eating in the morning. Okay, so that's one of those 10 things I put in my body that's worse than marijuana. Anyway, with that, why don't we jump into our first topic?
Let's do it.
We're all waiting to find out what's going to happen with the filibuster because so much rides on it, not least of which HR 1, this attempt to make it so that people can actually vote and fight back against a bit of the racist voter suppression that has been going on as long as our country has been a country and is once again happening in the wake of this most recent election. Now, we know that that racial component of the filibuster exists, that it's been used in that way before. But that is apparently debated by some people who are unfortunately in a position of power in this area. Take a look at what now Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell had to say about this.
Senate floor, you argue the filibuster is not rooted in racism. Historians differ on this. Are you concerned about the perception? If it is used against advancing voting rights, certainly the public perception is that Republicans are going to use this tool to make it harder for black people to vote.
Yeah, actually, historians do not agree. It has no racial history at all. None. So there's no dispute among historians about that. I make no apologies for opposing this bill. You've heard Senator Blunt outline the various flaws involved in it. This is all about a power grab. If it were related to civil rights, why were the Democrats using the tool last year and the year before that and the last 6 years? Why is it all of a sudden a civil rights issue when it wasn't for them as recently as last year? Honestly, with all due respect, that is nonsense. This is a power grab. It's all about trying to take over the American election system. It has all kinds of flaws. And under Senator Blunt's leadership, we're going to begin to point them out in great detail starting tomorrow in the Rules Committee.
Okay, so JR, it has nothing to do with race. And not only is that his view, but he can speak for all historians everywhere that they all aren't even in disagreement about it. They all agree that it has nothing to do with race. And he provides what he thinks counts as evidence of that. What do you think?
Well, we've got an issue, as W would say. We got an issue in America. So the issue we've got is that senators, congressmen, anyone who's an elected official is allowed to just lie about these things openly and directly and think that there's no recourse for it, that there's no one's going to double check that. Because these old men have been in Congress and Senate for 105 years and they're still used to the days when they can just say whatever they want and there's nobody that can immediately fact check or immediately look up what they just said. But at the same time, we're still listening to them as if they have this authority on the facts. So I don't know if it's a slow burn or if it's a weird transition from insanity to reality, but he's going to continue to say and do the things he was doing in 1991 now and then think that he can just get away with it only because he continues to get away with it. Now, then you can take to Twitter, you can take to YouTube, you can take to Facebook, you can take to wherever and people will openly dispute and debunk these lies. And then we'll just move on and say, Mitch McConnell lied again today. Not Mitch McConnell lied again today, and therefore something needs to be done about this. Or we need to disregard everything he says about this topic from now on. Or the next time he answers the question, someone follows up and says, but that's a lie, Minority Leader McConnell. That's not the reality of the situation. Those are the things that won't happen. We're only at this first step of people proving the lies the way we didn't before, because maybe the access to information wasn't there. So now the access to information is there, and we prove these lies, then we stop from letting them know, we know you're lying and we're not going to listen to you anymore. Instead, we're like, hey, Mitch McConnell, we know you're lying. Would you like to have more to say?
Yeah. Unfortunately, no amount of proof is really going to get through to Mitch McConnell, obviously, because he's not saying it because he thinks it's true. He's saying it because it would be convenient if people thought that it was true.
It would be inconvenient if someone followed up at that press conference and said, why are you lying?
Yeah.
Mitch? What's going on?
That would be
no
good.
No one, because he doesn't want to be on camera with that soundbite of him having to answer a question about why he's lying. Instead, the soundbite that's going to live is him saying vehemently how this is not has no racial history. There's no basis that it's ridiculous. Whenever they come out strong and direct like that, Donald Trump pointed this out. He was very strong in his denial. And that's just the end of the story. I don't care if you're strong in your denial. Murderers also say I didn't do it either, but it doesn't mean they didn't do it.
Yeah, or they say it just because they had a bad day. Anyway, so you might be right about that soundbite. So let's throw out another soundbite. He's wrong and he's lying and it matters that he's wrong. So let's show how he's wrong. Well, we're not really going to show it, but historians are going to show it, even though I had heard that they have no disagreement about this topic. So Kevin Cruz, who is a historian, had this thread of famous filibusters. We are just going to show you a few. There's a very long thread of it, but He points out a filibuster against anti-lynching bill against an anti-lynching bill in 1921. Then they did it in 22 and 25, and then they filibustered a monument to Black World War I veterans in 1926. To give you an idea of how important the stakes have to be for them to roll out the filibuster, they didn't want an acknowledgement of black soldiers who died in World War I. Let's see, they went back to filibustering anti-lynching bills in 1935 and 1938. And imagine living year by year for decades of them filibustering anti-lynching bills. And then there's a bill targeting racial discrimination in employment. They filibustered that. Truman civil rights proposals, they filibustered that. Then the civil rights movement started, and what do you know? Filibusters galore in 60, 62, 63, 64. And very importantly, you might think, well, you know, one filibuster a year. No, 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 he's not listing all the filibusters. He specifically says, I'm only using one per year, no matter how many there were. This might represent dozens, hundreds of filibusters against that particular bill.
Right.
Extension of the Voting Rights Act, they filibustered that in 82. Creation of MLK Day as a federal holiday, 1983. Filibuster against civil rights bill again in 1984. Decades and decades and decades and decades of racist filibusters. But there's no history and nobody doubts that. No historians certainly, except the ones who actually give a damn about what really happened in American history.
Yeah, so then what's the next step? There's no next step. He's not gonna be confronted with this reality. He's not gonna have to answer to it. And honestly, the people who listen to him and believe his lies, they're not gonna hear it either. That's the most important part. You will hear people repeatedly say,
They watch this show, JR. They watch the damage report.
They'll watch that press conference, or they'll watch Fox News carry that aspect of the press conference, and they'll go with that lie that there's no history to. By the way, there's racist history to every legislative piece that has or hasn't happened in this country, because this country was built on racism. It has to be. In order for them to, every step of the way that we've moved from the beginnings of Africans being brought here to now, has been them fighting that progression every step of the way. We act like we've gotten here because everyone's been so agreeable about getting here. I was saying yesterday, I think I tweeted this, Chuck Schumer said an attack on one of us is an attack on everyone. That's a nice line, it sounds good, but it's just not true. It's not true in this country. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of people who root for the injustice. For us to act like that would be given a disservice to the fact we need to change it. If we keep saying, hey, an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us, and act like all Americans think that way, people become complacent and go, oh, we're already there, we got that, case closed. Because we hear it all the time. People like to say all the time that we've gone so far since our racial history. Look how far we've gotten. Why don't you guys stop complaining? Look at the scene it is today versus what it was in 1960. Sure, but it doesn't mean we're there yet. We got to stop perpetuating the lie that we've gotten where we need to go, especially when you have people that are directly opposing it in legislation. Like, that's proof within itself. We're not there because they're opposing it.
Well, we shouldn't even need to respond to this, but one of his little arguments there was, it can't be racist if at some point the Democrats used it. Well, first of all, many of those filibusters that we were talking about were by the Democrats. Now, it was a different period of American history. It was before the Southern Strategy and realignment and all of that. That's way too much history for Republicans, so I'm not gonna wear them down with that. But I will point out that something being used for something doesn't mean we can't look at how generally is it used, and where most importantly is it used. Now, thankfully, people have done this. I wanna refer to some work that Sarah Binder wrote up in the Washington Post. They wanted to study how the filibuster has been deployed over the last century. So, to study filibusters after the Senate created cloture in 1917, she and Stephen Smith counted up measures that were killed by the filibuster. They sought evidence that a majority of the House, a majority of the Senate, and the president favored a measure, and yet it still died after debate on the Senate floor, which means the filibuster was the only thing that was able to kill it. There was unified agreement and control aside from the filibuster. So, in doing so, they found that of measures derailed by filibusters last century, civil rights measures dominated. Of the 30 measures we identified between 1917 and 1994, exactly half addressed civil rights, including measures to authorize federal investigation and prosecution of lynching, to ban the imposition of poll taxes, and to prohibit discrimination on the basis of race in housing, sales, and rentals. So, it can be used for all sorts of things, but over literally decades, half the time, even when one party had total control, they had control of the Senate, the House, and the presidency, the other side used the filibuster half the time to kill civil rights legislation. That is, like, I know that he doesn't know that, Mitch McConnell, and that he, more importantly, doesn't care about it. But it's important that you know that when people say that it is, like Obama called it, a relic of Jim Crow, It doesn't mean that there were some important cases where it involves race. It half the time was specifically about race. And that's a very important thing for us to know, not only for responding to Mitch McConnell, but also for people like Joe Manchin. For those who are going to try to fight to maintain the filibuster, we needed to deploy accurate history in trying to pressure them to stop doing that.
Yeah, and it needs to be said over and over and over again. And maybe the breakdown needs to have something to do with aspects of these voting rights laws that they're opposing. So if you're against people having access to the polling locations for a usable time or a certain communities, point out those specifics in your particular attacks instead of, you know, because I think people get lost in the weeds a little bit and it seems pretty straightforward, but maybe not, you know. So when Mitch McConnell can put his face in front of the camera and say that nothing has ever happened as far as the filibuster on that, he'd be like, so are you fighting against HR1, right? So we can pass some kind of voting rights that more people can vote. Why are you against it? And then start citing the things that did happen in history and be like, do you agree with that? Do you agree with that? Because that's the same thing that you're fighting against right now. The same thing you're fighting against or trying to re-implement that was actually taken out before. No one follows these things as closely as they should, honestly, to know all the details. That's why he can sit in front of a camera and lie like that. Because he knows the majority of people be like, oh yeah, I guess, you know, some guy who's an official said so. Must be the case. They need to be challenged, but they know no one will.
Exactly. Let's quickly move to one other aspect of this. The future of the filibuster matters for so many different areas, but as we keep saying, voting rights is, at least right now, one of the most important ones. And Chuck Schumer recently weighed in on that. And I want to show his video and give a little bit of a response to it, because it might not be exactly what you expect, but here is Chuck Schumer.
The Republican legislature voted to cut early voting by 9 days, close polls an hour earlier, and tighten rules on absentee voting. In Wisconsin, where urban and rural precincts face vastly different administrative burdens, Republicans have proposed limiting ballot drop boxes to only one municipality, no matter what its size. Could be 10,000 voters in a rural Republican county or 500,000 voters in an urban Democratic county, one ballot drop box. In Arizona, no fewer than 22 separate measures to limit voting rights have been introduced, including a bill to require every absentee ballot to be notarized. How are poor people going to pay for a notary when there's virtually no indication of fraud? This is one of the most despicable things I have seen in all my years. Shame, shame, shame.
Okay, so Chuck Schumer's totally right about a lot of that legislation. He's right about the notary in particular. It's just a poll tax. That's all it is. They found a way to do a poll tax that's not technically a poll tax. And JR, I want your response. I will say first though, shut up, Chuck Schumer. Honestly, like no, everything that he said is right, but I don't want you doing the speech on the floor of the Senate or whatever, and like saying shame, because shame isn't going to do anything. Like, it has nothing to do with anything. You need to do something. Like, and someone might respond, well, he's just pointing out how wrong they are. That's part of how you persuade people. Isn't that what you try to do, John and JR, on the show? Yes, we do. Because I can't do anything in the Senate. I have no actual power. All I have is hopefully trying to convince people. It's a perfectly fine thing to do. But if you have actual power, deploy that. Don't talk to the cameras. Don't talk to the Republicans. Talk to Joe Manchin. Talk to Kristen Sinema. Yes, the Republicans are against you, but they're not the most important ones who are against you if the goal is to get rid of the filibuster. You need to talk to your own people. They're not in the camera. They're sitting next to you. They're your colleagues. Do something about them with the actual power that you have.
No, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place because there's this mindset that Mitch McConnell still has the power. Because he keeps talking as if he has the power. Again, he's convincing even his colleagues that know better, or that should know better, that, oh, well, you just wait until we're back in power. Well, this is how it works, Democrats. If you take your opportunities when you do have the power and implement things that help the vast majority of American people, they will vote you back in. Yeah. Then you know who won't have the power? That a-hole who keeps talking about how much he's gonna dismantle the country further once he has power. He has so much perceived power that he keeps telling you about, that he's telling you what he's gonna do when he's out of power. And we're listening to him. The guy who lost is telling us what's gonna happen.
Yep.
The Super Bowl loser is taking the t-shirts and the hats from the winning team and putting them on and going, we won, we won. That doesn't work that way, bro. You know what's gonna happen if you do that? The entire fan base is gonna boo you and disparage you and talk about how much of a crazy loser you are. But for some reason in this game of direct wins and losses, the loser continues to control the conversation and we're listening to him. In fact, he gets mad about it as if you're supposed to listen to him. This is why it continues to happen, because they're afraid of what he's going to do once he gets back into power, because he keeps telling us how he's going to get back into power. He'll only get back into power if you don't do anything right now. And people go, oh, well, I guess the Democrats are the same as the Republicans, because the same bad things keep happening in my life. I can't tell the difference. And they're right.
Yes.
Because they can't tell the difference, because the lines of differences in their policies keep mixing. So every once in a while, Joe Biden and his administration will come up with something decent to do, then they won't really do it. So people will hear, I heard Joe Biden was doing great things, but they don't know that it never happened because he allowed them not to let him do it. So everybody's the same now. So who cares? Mitch McConnell will be back in power. Now we're afraid of what he's gonna do. He's gonna destroy the Senate. Bro, it's one of the most frustrating aspects of our entire government that I have to look at every day.
Yeah, and there's a lot of competition for that. Supposedly, like I read this thing on Yahoo News, and supposedly Biden's like getting like all hyped to like go big and get rid of the filibuster. Okay, that's great, get hyped and you know talk to Yahoo News or whatever, but also talk to your people. They're the ones who can stop you from changing the filibuster.
Talk to the American people. How many people and regular citizens watched that hearing? That was a great little speech. I'm not against anything that he said there.
And neither am I.
Hear it, you know? Or is it going to be in ads? Is it going to be on appearances on regular television networks? You know? I don't know. Maybe there will be, because he does do TV. So
that's true. That's true.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Recently, we've been talking about a couple of very high profile mass shootings here in the United States. And one of the things that makes them so surprising is because we've had this period where there weren't a lot of mass shootings. For once in America, we went a while without them. For exactly a year, actually, that first year of the pandemic, the US didn't see a single high profile public mass shooting. There were only two public shootings in 2020 that primarily targeted strangers, were not related to other crimes, and killed at least four victims. That is one standard definition that researchers use to classify mass shootings. That's the lowest annual count of high profile mass shootings in America in nearly a quarter century. So, you know, if we're lucky enough to have pandemics for the rest of our life, maybe that'll cut down a bit on the mass shootings. That'll be nice. But anyway, that does not mean, though, that we didn't have gun violence. We had gun violence. We had a lot of gun violence. We just didn't have it in the very high profile way that we generally do. But what we had was a lot of people being killed by guns. Take a look at this chart. 2020 had 19,380 gun homicides, which is not just high. It is, in fact, a record. And we also had a record number of gun injuries, you can see there, with nearly 40,000. So a lot of people were being shot, even if it wasn't necessarily in a big, mass, open, public sort of way. We beat the previous record of 2017 by more than 3,600 murders. You had some of the country's largest cities getting a 30% spike in gun homicides. I mean, just huge numbers. And, you know, this is probably not connected at all. But you also had a spike in gun purchases during the early months of the pandemic. An 8% increase in the US between March and May. I no longer even understand the spikes in gun purchasing. When is there not a spike in gun purchasing? Isn't it just a gradual linear raise over time, JR? It seems like no matter what is happening in times of, when a Democrat comes in, oh, they're gonna take your guns, you gotta get it. When it's a Republican, it's like, oh, they might come back in eventually, you gotta get a gun.
Yeah, there's an argument for it's like a used car salesman. They always find a way to turn whatever is just said into somehow a sales job. So no matter what the situation is, there's a line for that, you know. As you just said, you know, Democrats in office, oh man, they're coming to take your guns. And for some reason, these suckers that keep buying these lemons from the used car lot keep buying this argument that somehow Democrats are gonna take your guns away. It's been decades of them taking your guns away. Man, I wish they'd hurry up and get to this, because it's nowhere near it. Keeps almost happening. And then there's another one coming down the pike. This one's really gonna do it. You remember the last time when Obama took your guns away and you hoarded guns and none were taken away? Again, there has to be, let people revisit reality. Because when you get caught up in a spin cycle of BS over and over and over again, people believe it. And you have to wake people up sometimes and go, hey, how many guns do you have, Jed? How many got taken away? None have been taken away, bro. And the ones that did get taken away or were confiscated, it's because people, you were stockpiling them in your house before you went on Facebook and started threatening to kill elected officials. Then they came in and found your stockpile of guns. Is that the taken away of guns we're talking about? Again, ask people who continue to vote to allow guns to be widespread and to be scattered all across the country to anybody who has a finger to pull the trigger. Challenge them to ask them, do you support this? Look at what's happening. Do you support this? They're never asked to support actually what they're supporting. They're just told, oh, I'm a Second Amendment gun-toting American patriot. What does that mean? It means you support any and everyone getting a gun and carrying out these types of murders. We also hear about, sorry, I'm gonna filibuster on you, ironically, John. We keep hearing about how Republicans were concerned about people being locked up in their houses and depression and domestic violence, which all upticked during the pandemic. Obviously, because people are in closer quarters around each other. So violent people are gonna do violent things to whoever's near them. There weren't mass congregations of people around, so there was fewer mass shootings. If there's no masses, there's no mass shooting. That's all there was to it. Instead, these people have to use the guns for something, either on themselves or the people near them. That's what's going on. So if you're concerned about people in the pandemic being holed up and killing each other, maybe we should be concerned about that rather than just using it as a talking point to use these people that have issues to continue and push your sales job for more guns.
Yeah, there's no, we talked about this yesterday. There's no, so what do you want? There's nothing that they want. Like, when it turned out that the guy in this most recent shooting was non-white, had a non-white name, now they love that because they can like use his name. They don't name the other shooters, notably. So they use it, but like, okay, so you're really, so he's Muslim, so you're really scared of him. And then, so what? Would you not want him to have that AR? Oh no, you're still totally cool with him having had that AR. Like, you wanna like sort of get close, like, in theory, they've probably debated, well, could we like specifically stop Muslims from having guns? No, that still seems like gun control and that's a bad precedent to set. But no, they don't want any of this. They literally wanted people on the terrorist watch list to still have guns. Like, there's nothing. They'll fearmonger a bit about it, but there's no solution. That's why they say the thoughts and prayers. There's nothing else for them to say. Now, I wanna give you an update. So we talked about that record last year. Let's take a look at this year. Before the two most recent mass shootings, there have been, this is as of just March 1st, this is actually a couple of weeks out of date, 3,045 gun deaths, 5,300 gun injuries, 73 mass shootings, 144 children shot, 599 teenagers shot, 194 incidents of defensive gun use, 282 unintentional shootings, and nearly 4,000 suicides using firearms. And when I saw that, I thought, wait, no, that 3,000 deaths in the first 2 months, but Yeah, no, that's actually how it works out in America. It's insane. It seems like it couldn't possibly be true, but that's how bad it is. And one other aspect, JR, of how bad it is that after the record breaking last year, after these insane first 2 months of this year, after these two insane mass shootings, Joe Manchin still opposed the House's gun control bills despite those shootings. He's got his own thing he wants to do. He's not a fan of anything that the Democrats have passed.
Joe Manchin is continuing his political push to try and be the most important politicians in the country. Because again, he's opposing some kind of actual legislation that will do something because he's in favor of his own that he can tout as bipartisan. Yeah. That's all he cares about. Anything Joe Manchin ever says, it goes back to him promoting himself as this middle of the ground hero who's working with Republicans, but not working with Democrats. So I'm still trying to find where the bipartisanship part is, because you and a Republican is not a bipartisan bill. It's a Republican bill that you're using to try and look a certain way so you can continue to be elected. That's all this is. The selfishness and self-serving nature that Joe Manchin has been pushing for I don't know how long. I feel like it's pretty obvious. Anytime he speaks, just ask him. So Joe Manchin, why are you promoting yourself? What is it about this that's promoting him? That's all this ever is. I'm just the middle of the ground guy, John. I'm just here because I'm speaking for the people of West Virginia. And you know what they don't want? They don't want a minimum wage increase. They don't want safety. They want to keep getting shot. I'm just saying what West Virginians want. Tired of them. Really,
you know,
tired.
I hesitate to even play this next video because I don't want to distract from how bad he is in this area, since in this case, he's more important to the future of gun control than the person I'm about to show. But I gotta show this video. Yesterday, during a previously scheduled gun control hearing, here is what Republican Senator Kennedy had to say about the prospects for gun control.
But you don't stop drunk drivers by getting rid of all sober drivers, which is what many of my Democratic friends want to do with respect to the Second Amendment. In my judgment, we do not need more gun control. We need more idiot control.
I know where we could start. But anyway, I want to be careful about this. He sounds like one of the dumbest people I've ever heard in my life. And how is he getting elected to office? Like, I'm assuming, I could be wrong, I haven't Googled this. When do you think the last time he had a debate was, honestly? Like, how could, anyway. So he's got an analogy for you, JR. We need idiot control. We need it to be like, not this crazy idea that the left has about controlling guns. It needs to be like the Wild West of cars, where anything goes. There's no government regulation, nothing.
What does idiot control entail?
Would you want to do some sort of check for an idiot, maybe into their background? Would you want to check the background of potential idiots? Would you want to do that?
Once politicians start giving, you know, pundit type answers like that, because I get it. Maybe a pundit may say that because, you know, they're a talk show host or something, and they're on the radio, and they should just say something. And they don't have to have all the answers because they're just a pundit that want to push a certain perspective that they wish would go somewhere. If you're a lawmaker, maybe you have an idea of what else we can do. Since you don't want any gun control, you want idiot control. What does that look like? What's idiot control? Are you writing up the legislation? Is it bipartisan? Are you working with Joe Manchin on idiot control? Mm-hmm. It's so frustrating, man.
Now, look, JR, you're expecting a lot because, you know, he's spitballing, obviously, because this is the first instance of gun violence we've had. He's just coming up with this right now. So, should we, for instance, do the background checks of idiots? Should we, for instance, because we don't know if a particular person is an idiot, should we maybe like pump the brakes and make them wait a bit before getting the gun? Should we do that? What if a guy is such an idiot that he like routinely beats his girlfriend or his wife and we know about that? Should he be banned from getting a gun? In all of these cases, no. Even if we know this person is an idiot or awful or clearly shouldn't have a deadly weapon, he has no interest in that. It's like the recent talk on the right about child sexual assault. They like it in theory. They like talking about it. It seems reasonable. There's literally nothing they want to do that would actually be an example of it. They are perfectly fine with idiots having guns because an idiot buying the gun is the same as a regular person buying the gun from the point of a person who wants to sell you a gun. And that is what the end goal of all of this is.
It's weird because idiot control, maybe you can identify them with background checks. It's weird how that might work. How do we discover the idiots?
We don't. Not if he has anything to say about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. That's the point, to do nothing.
In many states, it is getting much easier to get access to the vaccine, with some of the requirements changing in terms of which industries are getting access, which pre-existing conditions, the age limits are dropping in a lot of places, not everywhere. And definitely check your state and check your locality, but it is changing. That said, there have been all along little ways along the edges to potentially jump the line a little bit. And I've been very curious to find out what people think about this. Now, famously, we used as one of our garbage people the two women in Florida who put on makeup to look like grandmothers could go. Just madness. But that is just the most comical version of trying to skip the line. So what do people think about other ones? Well, there's a great poll up on YouGov that we're going to talk about. So for instance, volunteering at a vaccine clinic to get a vaccine, which, look, at the very least, you are working. It's a little bit, I mean, would you if you weren't getting the vaccine? But 70% of people think that that's acceptable. 24% think that it's not. So generally, people are like, if you work for it, sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I can't. Why would I find one person?
How many hours, JR? How many hours should you have to work?
If you work one day, you get that. Absolutely. Okay. That's help. Because, you know, listen, I've seen the lines and everything of how these are going. And that's work all day. That's work, man. I'm sure there's shifts and stuff. That's you're delivering potentially life-saving vaccines for people. That's an important job. And if you do it for one day, how many people have you helped? That's worth it, bro.
That is true. And by the way, you are, of course, at least a little bit opening yourself up to getting sick. Like, you know, and so the people that are there have to be vaccinated for their own safety.
Totally.
Okay, so that's an easy one. How about accepting a vaccine that would have otherwise expired and been thrown out? So 69%, and I say that would be acceptable, 25% say no. So this is where, you know, you either lurk around one of these places at the end of the day, or you call ahead so that if someone doesn't show up for their appointment, you know, there's a certain number of doses in each vial. They can't re-refrigerate it once they've opened it. So if they only use two, somebody should get those. Interestingly, it was a little bit less accepted than the volunteering, JR. What do you think about that?
That's weird. Even more so, I mean.
These two would be wasted. Like,
these
that
two
just
for me,
like a slam dunk.
Yeah, the first one I said is 100. If I could go over 100%, I would on this one even more. What's the problem? You'd rather, so 25% of people, at least that were polled here, would rather see doses wasted than to go to someone.
That is interesting.
That's actually helpful to you who doesn't have it, bro. It's so weird. I don't know.
I don't get it. Especially because that's the one that I might try at some point. I never have an afternoon open to try, but I do want to try eventually. Anyway, those are the only two that have very widespread appeal. So once you jump down to like crossing line, state lines to get a vaccine, only 41% support it, 54 don't. Probably because when someone sees that, they think, well, I don't want someone from Arizona coming to California and getting it. So they don't like that. Using a vaccine appointment access code that was not intended for you, only 15% support that.
Yeah.
Which we've had a couple of scandals about that. Offering a bribe, 13% of the country's like, yeah, you should be able to bribe doctors.
No.
It's a weird position. Yeah. Why are you okay with that? Is that like the top 13%? Do we have a country where 13% of the population is like ready to bribe somebody? Like they have the resources to do it?
I think there's more. If more people had the kind of resources where they could bribe someone, it'd be way more bribes. It's just people don't have any money. Yeah. That's the only problem.
Now you might think the bribe should be the lowest, but I don't know. Falsely claiming to have a qualifying medical condition, 12% support that. That's pretty messed up.
Yeah,
like claiming you have asthma or you had a respiratory, like an immune disorder or something, and falsely claiming to be an essential worker is also at 12%. Both of those,
yeah,
that's pretty filthy.
Yeah, whenever you're in making an impression of someone else, or you're acting like you're someone else that should be in that position, that's where many of my lines are drawn. Because again, at the end of the day, we do want more people vaccinated, but the thing is, you want people who are at higher risk to be vaccinated first. That's the only thing as far as the line here. And there's a reason why the first two, I think, were so much higher, because you're doing it legitimately. When it's illegitimate, that's when we have a problem. That's really where the lines would be drawn for me. Because even if you're like, hey, you know, I work in this field, and even though it's nearby, if you're working in a field that would get you sick, I have no problem with it. Even if it's not on some approved list, if you're still working in a field that could get you sick and get more people sick, that's a benefit to everyone. I'm down.
Yeah, it is interesting though, that like the gap between the highest and the lowest. So falsely claiming to be an essential worker, only 12%. Temporarily becoming an essential worker, 70%. So just like, do a day's work. Like it's not that much. You want to get out of the house anyway, don't you?
Yeah. Anyway. Well, and actually, there's a weird mix I have. The state line one, I'm a little shaky on, only because if you cross a state line because it's more available in another nearby state, but you're still not jumping someone else's line. Like if you cross state lines and you have the right requirements, why am I mad?
Yeah.
Like you still should get it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm totally open to be wrong about this stuff.
No, I don't trust any of the people in states surrounding California. Stay out. Stay out. But I will go to your state. How about that? Anyway. Okay. So by the way, we polled people. Maybe we can throw up the poll again. Find out what they think about skipping the line in one of these ways. We're gonna read those results at the end of the show. But with that, why don't we jump ahead to our next topic? One of the great things about Donald Trump no longer being president is that so many of the people that he picked to serve with him are also not around. Like it's great to not have Stephen Miller. That's amazing. One of the most reprehensible villains in his administration was certainly Betsy DeVos. And so I think a lot of people felt pretty good once she was booted out of DC. You might feel a little bit less good when you find out that she's leaving, having earned so much money while she was in office. She's reportedly worth more than $2 billion, which as an aside, nobody should be worth, but she apparently is. Reported outside earnings from dividends, interest, and rents of at least $225 million, potentially over $414 million, just during her time in the Trump administration. And when I look at her on her way out, I think, that's someone who did a couple $100 million worth of work over those couple of years. That's what I think. Anyway, the figures were found through an analysis of three of her financial disclosure forms conducted by Crew. The organization notes that it's difficult to know her exact income as it's reported in broad ranges. Many assets are listed as being over 5 million or over 1 million instead of giving exact figures. At the most modest end of a reported income, she would have earned more than $158,000 every day for the 1,422 days she was in the position. That's more than $6,500 per hour. And if I was slightly better with numbers, I could tell you by the minute. I think I could get close. Anyway, that's so much money day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year for dividends and interest and stuff. She didn't have to do anything to earn that money, JR.
As a matter of fact,
frustrating.
Actually, matter of fact, it's probably even more it's easier for her not to do anything. If she did something, she may have done it wrong. Because I don't know, I don't see much expertise here. I don't see much of a mastermind of a business nature where she can generate all this money because of her genius. So it's really based on doing nothing. It's based on who you are and who you're married to and who you're connected with and which business is there. Because, okay, Betsy DeVos is a garbage person, bottom line. So outside of that,
maybe this week.
Outside of that though, all it is just her being a cog in the machine. So if there's a company, corporation that you're associated with that's making hundreds of millions of dollars over a couple years or so, Betsy DeVos is not the driving force behind that. She's just one of the beneficiaries of it. So it's not like she could go in there and be like, okay, we're gonna stop everything. This is capitalism, bro. One person is gonna go in there and stop a machine of a corporation that has been making this kind of money regularly, and then suddenly they're just gonna stop doing it. So honestly, and this is where maybe I'm a bad guy, people that are in these types of positions are not qualified to hold government positions. That's just the way it is, bro. You got your hundreds and hundreds of million dollars. I'm sorry, your $2 billion. You've got that. What are you in What are you being appointed a government position for? To help who? And when we see you're not helping anyone, in fact, making more money because the corporation that you're associated with does nothing but make money. That's their job. Why are you here? We don't need you, and you don't need us. All that's going to happen is a bad relationship here. And maybe that sounds like it's bad to limit people from having a job or government position because they want to serve their country. But it's just, it's impossible. It doesn't work that way. Association with a capitalist corporation like this, you cannot serve the people. You just can't do it, even if you wanted to, because your company and your business holdings and your family is still making tons and tons of money. So it's a direct conflict of interest, even if it's not your fault. It's just the way it is.
Well, you know, and the US Constitution has, at least technically on the books, some concern for how money can influence you coming in from like foreign nationals or something. But like, what about just the natural way that you'll be influenced by all of what goes into you being able to earn hundreds of thousands of dollars every day passively through your investments? And we don't even need to speculate like hypothetically how that could influence you or how that could provide a conflict of interest. She and her husband provide perfect examples of that. So she had a stake in NeuroCore, a brain performance company aimed at children, as well as her husband's political donations, which she pledged he would stop making when she was entering government. But then she remembered, oh wait, we make more money if we don't do that because they'll give us what we want. DeVos did not recuse herself from matters involving NeuroCore that brought up potential conflicts of interest. And her husband continued to make political donations in the 2018 and 2020 election cycles. So are we supposed to believe that that had no influence? That as head of the Department of Education, she didn't do anything that would benefit NeuroCore, not because that's what's best for America's children, but because that's what's best to make her marginally more insanely wealthy than she already is? Like, we don't have any sort of requirement that people to serve have below a certain net worth or that they get rid of their investments. But it seems like it makes a lot of sense to do one or both, honestly.
Actually, sadly, I think a lot of times there are requirements in the opposite. That people have to have certain wealth, certain business holdings, certain associations, and certain connections in order to be considered to run. That's just the way historically it's been. So the rich and powerful, why would they choose a poor nobody to run and help represent the things that they've been representing? You know, when people hold power, it's not the top of their agenda list to give it up.
Yeah.
So a lot of people that get appointed to these positions, the ones that can continue this continuous. We talked earlier about Mitch McConnell. He was calling Democrats in the Senate wanting to change rules so we can have voting rights. He called it a power grab because that would make him lose power because the American people wouldn't vote for him. It's a power grab because he would lose power. That's the problem. It's a bunch of people who want ultimate power and they're calling the other one a power grabber. Each of you is doing the same thing. It's just a matter of who's gonna grab the power. So it's such a false argument to make in the first place. That's the whole point. Powerful people wanna keep their power and then they'll do anything they can, like appoint people like Betsy DeVos who don't know anything, to continue to hold that power because they have no other choice. Sure. She's just another bolt in the machine.
Yeah, 100%. Did a lot of damage, comes out, made a ton of money. She was gonna be fine either way. Why would you want these people serving? Well, if you wanted the Department of Education.
No one actually does. No one wants those people to serve except for the people who
appoint. No actual people. Yeah, and you know, so it's so weird. Like, you know, you would expect that this incredibly wealthy person using their position in government to get even wealthier, damn the interests of the state. That's the sort of thing that, like, you know, a populist news show like Tucker Carlson in theory could be influenced in. But I have a feeling he's not gonna have an interest in that. He'll talk generally about the ruling class and the elites, but he's not going to identify the actual ones, certainly not those that served under Republicans. Anyway, with that, let's talk about another out of touch rich woman. Here we go. There's this debate about the fact that the Biden administration and the aid bill is providing some additional aid to clear the debts of black farmers. It led to, for instance, Crowder's insanely racist comedy thing. Well, it's also led to some other funny bits of video, including this from Meghan McCain, who wants to take a stand against people's identity being involved in them getting jobs.
excluded women farmers. And so we're going to a place where even if people need money, even if people are qualified to get into Ivy Leagues, race and gender is more important than your skill qualifications, the content of your character. It is not what Martin Luther King Jr. preached. I think this is a very, very slippery slope. I was very surprised to hear someone like Tammy Duckworth say something like this. She got a lot of blowback from a lot of people, not just on the right. And I think this is actually just the natural progression of identity politics. And I will say, just to put a cap on this, The View is 25 years old next year. We've only had one Asian American host co-host this show. So does that mean that one of us should be leaving at some point because there's not enough representation? There, we're talking about, is identity politics more important than qualifications of a job? And I think that's a question going forward that the progressive left is going to have to reconcile.
Okay, and before we go, because we're going to go and take a break, eventually we're going to come back and talk about the black farmer.
I just love Whoopi's reactions. Okay, so Meghan McCain is here to tell you a few things, but one, JR, is that it's someone's skill qualifications that should be the only thing that determines if they get a position, which is how The View has typically chosen people. Those with the most skill and qualifications get the job.
By the way, if The View would like to, I guess, have representation from an Asian American woman on the show because they've noticed that their demographics are failing in that area, that's up to them. Because that helps people. They see someone that they identify with and maybe has points of view that identify with theirs to have a discussion on air. That's all The View is. It's folks talking about issues and having their point of view and perspective and discussing them. So if you don't have someone who represents an aspect of the country that may have views that you don't because you didn't live them, that's not a lack of qualification. That's just, where's the qualification for being, the qualification for being on The View is to be able to speak and have a conversation. Some people aren't good at public speaking. Some people aren't good at having cameras in their face and lights and people talking in their ears and stuff. So those are the qualifications you need to be able to speak. So if you don't have those, I feel you. But the thing is, we're gonna find that out on the first day if this Asian American woman comes on The View and then goes, welcome? Is that the word? So if you don't know how to speak and broadcast, sure, you're gonna have an issue. But having your point of view somehow because of who you are is a bad thing because you're trying to find representation for people who may wanna watch and see what she has to say. I'm trying to find the bad part in that. It's is this assumption, and this is a basis in the white supremacy from the first place, which I don't think many people understand, not even white folks that are buying into it, because everyone buys into it. There's this assumption that if you hire someone and you have these qualifications for a demographic they should be, age, gender, race, background, whatever background you want to base it on, there's this automatic assumption, which she just made, that they're unqualified. Why is that?
Totally.
Based on what? That's a sweeping across the board assumption that if you are this minority that's being underrepresented and someone says we need that underrepresented person in our business, in our government, in our show, that somehow they're unqualified for it. Your starting point is that people that are underrepresented are unqualified for any position. That's supremacy.
Yeah, and so which areas of identity shouldn't be used for choosing it, because The View has always had one conservative person. That's what they do. That's why Meghan McCain is there. She wasn't chosen, first of all, she wasn't chosen to be the conservative because of her skills. She was chosen, I guess there was one skill, as Parker Malloy pointed out on Twitter, she was the fastest sperm that John McCain was capable of producing that particular day. That was the skill that she had. But the fact that there's a conservative at all is because they want representation, because they think that's valuable for some reason that has nothing to do with skills. That's why Meghan McCain has that job. And when she eventually gets fired from this job, that's why she'll have her next job. It's because somebody wants to give the wealthy woman who is related to the senator some sort of position because they believe it'll benefit them in some way. But think about the implication. First of all, as many people pointed out, I would like to thank the hairstylist for styling her after one of the people from the Capitol as she talks about how skills and qualifications are all that matters. Really do appreciate that. But so she pointed out The View in its 20 plus years has never had an Asian woman as one of the hosts. So Meghan McCain, do you believe that's because there's never been an Asian woman qualified to talk about the news? Is that why? What I love about all these arguments is they will say, let's not take race into account because, and they'll almost never make this explicit, because I stupidly think that race hasn't been taken into account this whole time when it has.
Yep.
We should take race into account with the black farmers because race has always been taken into account when it comes to farmers. It's just benefited white farmers until then. It has always been taken into account on The View and shows like it in a way that has benefited white people. That is the status quo. It is not race blind or race neutral. This is an attempt to make it equal by recognizing race yet again, but in a way that doesn't exclusively benefit generally wealthy, generally attractive white women in this particular case.
It's a parallel to the whole cancel culture argument that Republicans, conservatives like to push, that, oh my God, look at all this cancel culture going on. Suddenly we're canceling people. Bro, y'all have been canceling people since the beginning. This is just the way it's always been. So when women come into the office, they've been canceled unless they're gonna satisfy your sexual desires. Minorities come into the office, they're gonna get canceled because of their name before they even get the job. People get discriminated against widely on a regular basis. This is the norm. Anytime the norm is racism, which it is, any change to that is gonna threaten the people who benefit from it. It's just the way it is. Hey, as I always say it, because I like to make sure you guys understand, I understand this personally too. I'm a man in the United States. I have benefits that women don't have. I just do, straight up. Now, there's some people who have more benefits than I do, and some people have less. But to say that suddenly I don't have any kind of benefit because of who I am, and people in economy on the street, they have a different perception of me, sometimes positive, sometimes negative, but there is positive ones that I have. And I've been able to get jobs based off of where I went to school without knowing any about my background, education, what I studied. People offer me a job because they said, oh, you went to USC? Trust, it happens. It's straight up based off of just who you are, where you come from, and they look at that. But if they see Melvin Jenkins on an application, he gets canceled. It just happens. If they see Sharika Jones on an application, they go, she's an idiot. That's the way we've done things. So instead, when someone says, hey, how about you listen to what Sharika has to say first? They go, oh my God, canceling.
Yep.
Really? Really? Cancel because you have to consider someone that previous to this, you decided you just is unworthy of even consideration, but bootstraps.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
I just, I guess I have to look forward to next year, John Oliver making her a pop. Like, you just got done apologizing for your racial insensitivity like 3.5 minutes ago. And now you roll through to this.
And by the way, people
learning is not a qualification, I guess.
They want Meghan McCain gone. And honestly, they brought her in because they were underrepresented with this conservative younger woman point of view. So they brought her in. She was qualified because they wanted that demographic. I don't care, they can hire who they want. But maybe there's a certain percentage of conservative women who watch The View now that weren't before because Meghan McCain is there. Mission accomplished, ABC, they did what they wanted. I'm happy for you, I hope it works out for you because that was your business decision based off of what you think is gonna help people watch the show. So if an Asian woman's gonna help people watch the show, hire her.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's the same thing with anyone.
No, there are certain identities that just very naturally get taken into account and benefited, and we should never question that. But anything other than that, well, that's just unfair. Anyway, let's super fast roll through our last story just because I think it's kind of funny.
Sure.
So we're going to jump into this. We're still waiting to see what's going to end up happening with the attempt to recall Gavin Newsom. And if it does happen, if there is going to be an election, there are going to be a lot of people who are coming out of the woodwork to try to get involved in that race. We're starting to see little inklings of that around the edges, including a throwback to the Democratic primary of 2020 that I didn't expect to see in the news again, at least so soon. Tom Steyer, he has an organization that commissioned a wide-ranging poll on a number of issues impacting the state's political landscape. I would say as cover for the true question, which is, are you prepared to get rid of Gavin Newsom? But like, no, that's just like one of the things I'm asking about. I'm also interested in all this other stuff too. Anyway, then they had a bunch of options for who Democrats could support if Newsom was to be booted out. And what do you know, Tom's on the list. And so I think that's hilarious, but even more so once you know his history in this area. So understand that we, like I said, we still don't know what's gonna happen. They need 1.5 million valid voter signatures to have it qualify for the fall recall, which is obviously a lot. It doesn't happen very often. And Sire says he's not in favor of any of this. He's against it. But like, if it does happen, and he could run easily. Apparently, a lot of people can, because the steps to qualify, you need $4,000 or 7,000 signatures. I think he'll be able to scrape together the money for that. But interestingly, in 2015, after now Vice President Kamala Harris, US Senate campaign, Steyer told potential supporters he was considering jumping into that race. 2 years later, he was potentially interested in challenging Dianne Feinstein, which he didn't do. Then he ran for president. This guy doesn't necessarily know what he wants to do. It's president, it's governor, it's senator, but he wants to do something and he wants it to be big. This dude ain't running for city council, JR.
Yeah, I was thinking, man, like, try again. You know, if at first you don't succeed. I mean, he made a bunch of money as a business guy. You know, what was it? He did worked the stock market or something, whatever his business was. He made tons of money on. So, hedge fund.
I think he's the one that made those Bloomberg terminals. I think he was a billionaire. The races with that.
Yeah.
Billionaire. Yeah, confused about billionaires. Anyway.
Yeah, billionaire nonetheless. And the thing is, he has a background for getting, you know, progressives in office. He's a big environmentalist guy, so that's been his niche. That's been his how he's whittled his way into the political landscape, which is fine in my opinion, right? But I don't know if there. I guess I'm never was a believer in, like, you know, political capital and things like that when someone gets elected. But maybe there's a degree of spending political capital as far as trying to get any position possible, because it starts to kind of look that way. Even though if he gets one of these positions, he may be just perfectly fine. But it's pretty obvious that he's just trying. I mean, if someone's going to appoint this guy, you know, statewide dog catcher, he's going to be like, got it.
It isn't pointed out enough how, like, arrogant running for office is, even if you're qualified, by the way, to think that you should be president, even if, like, you're exactly the sort of person who always runs, is arrogant. But, like, the people are like, screw all those lower things. Congress, I'm doing Congress now. It's just so crazy arrogant. It's like, imagine thinking, man, I rocked South Bend so bad, the whole country needs me. It's just such an amazingly arrogant thing that politics is.
John, I'm gonna grab this tape.
That was a random city chosen.
I just ran. Yeah, no, no. And I'm gonna play it back for you in like 6 years when you run for office. And be sure. Like, look at the. When I'm working for, I don't know, somebody who's running against you, look at the pompous nature after I take the red pill, or is it the blue pill? Which pill do I have to take to be an insane?
Take them both, just in case. Purple pill.
The purple pill. It's like, I took the purple pill and I worked with John Adirola. He said he'd never run for office. Listen to 2021.
And there's gonna be, and then like, then the my screen's gonna go black, and there's gonna be like really aggressive violin music or something. Yeah, he's gonna take me down. Anyway, by the way, Tom Steyer, he wasn't like the worst.
No,
he was like one of the better ones, but it's still arrogant, dude. It's still arrogant. Nice tie though.
Maybe he'll do something good. Maybe do something good. You're right. I do like his ties too.
Maybe we'll see. Anyway, JR, before you go, let's find out what happened with that poll, because we asked people about vaccination. Are they gonna just sort of patiently wait their turn, or are they gonna try to use one of the little ways to get ahead a little bit? And we had you voting at tyt.com/poll/vaccination plan. How did that turn out? Okay, it looks like we've got both in the 40. Okay, the numbers, 49.5% have already been vaccinated. What? Only 46.5% of you are waiting your turn. Oh, how polite. Only 4% are interested in any of those. Sort of loopholes. Wow. First of all, geez, you guys are getting vaccinated. That is awesome. I guess hopefully, like, if we could have had any influence, we've been trying to get people to do it. I guess that maybe has been helpful. But and those of you who haven't, very patient. Admirable.
Yeah, this is
I so far have, but
yeah, I think it's like you know, a lot of people are hitting those, you know, those qualifications. In certain states, they're lighter than they are here. And there's plenty of essential workers. It could be a nice percentage of that. So
that's true. It's true.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I like it too. The only thing I'd like more is Sprocket.
Yeah, he's
around the couch. No, he's not around. Oh well.
Not around.
Unfortunately, full of sprockets. But
before I go, though, I did see one. For some reason, I never pay close attention to these, but one of the super chats, I think. Maybe you're going to read it when I was gone, but I want to wish happy birthday to KT Watkins. Today is their birthday. It fell on a JR Wednesday. You know what? They're speaking to my heart. So, you know, of course, I'm going to shout this one out. So, shout out to KT Watkins. Happy birthday, 21st birthday. Have a drink today. I'm sure you just turned 21. They're melanated dragon in their own mind. Yeah. So,
nice.
I love it.
Nice.
That's what I want to be part of that shout out. That's all.
That's true. Thank you for pointing that out. Before you go, I wanted to give you a chance to react. I think it's Craig in the chat. He's got a great point that blows out of the water everything I just said about the poll results. He's like, the people who are vaccinated already just use the loopholes. That wasn't one of the choices.
Oh, yeah.
It's like 54% of the audience, one way or another, I'm using the loophole. I haven't been successful in doing so yet, but I'm going to. Anyway, thank you, Craig.
And the last 4% are like, maybe I should.
Anyway, JR, as always, thank you for joining us for the Big News Wednesday. And hope to talk to you soon.
I think we did it some justice.
Good stuff. I think we did. We had fun.
Thanks.
We are less than a month out from Earth Day, which is a special day here at TYT. And in fact, we will be having a special, as we always do. We're going to be bringing in environmental activists and guests to join us and talk about the environment, the climate, what Biden is doing, what can possibly happen, all of that. But one of the things that might make this particular Earth Day a little bit more special is that the president has indicated that he plans to introduce a net zero strategy on Earth Day. And joining us now to talk about net zero, how you get there, the consequences of all of this, and the political conversation going on around it, is a net zero policy engagement fellow at the University of Oxford. Kaya Axelson joins us now. Kaya, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Very glad to have you here. Interestingly, as we go live with this, you're actually in the process of watching a hearing that's going on right now, which bears on this conversation. So tell me a little bit about the conversation around net zero, what's likely to happen politically.
Absolutely. So what is so exciting to me about the hearing that we could be watching right now as this is being filmed, it's a hearing on the US setting a net zero target. So we have committed to re-enter the Paris Agreement because the Biden administration has made that a top priority. But it would be really great if the legislature could also get on board behind a net zero target. So the Clean Futures Act is doing that, is making that commitment. And not only does it kind of commit us to a net zero target by 2050, but it also commits us to a 50% emissions reduction target by 2030, which would be major, and it would put us on track to meet the Paris Agreement target to limit warming to 1.5 degrees.
And you know, there's been a lot of different plans generally to combat climate change, specifically having to do with when we should be hitting these different thresholds. You know, I don't know how many points we want to have on that spectrum, but generally speaking, how aggressive would you consider this plan?
This plan is not aggressive. This plan is just based on the best available science, the IPCC report, which tends to be a bit conservative because that's scientists around the world coming together to agree. And so what we are actually seeing in this plan is a very kind of moderate response. It's in line with global best practice, right? You've got over 60% of the world now signed up to a net zero target by 2050. That's the bare minimum that we could do. If we want to lead, we should go sooner than that.
Okay. And of course, having the goals and the targets is important, but there's always a question of, so how do we make sure that we're actually going to meet that? And if we don't, what are the consequences? In that area, what is the enforcement and oversight like on this bill?
So the bill has several sort of regulatory measures, and that's particularly what Republicans are pushing back on. A few Republicans on the committee have said, on the House committee have said, that they feel this is a rush to green. And that's probably because they've got some donors in the fossil fuel industry who don't like the sound of regulation. Overall, however, the bill does not necessarily put out very strict kind of reporting mechanisms. And so I think that that's something that we can expect to see in the strategy that Biden outlines on Earth Day. We're going to see, I mean, So there's the legislature and there's what they can do in terms of the budget and how this bill, the Clean Futures Act, incentivizes new renewable energy and new clean jobs. But then there's also the incredible leverage point that the Biden administration has just with the federal government as fingertips in terms of what we can do in terms of spending on EVs. I mean, EVs alone could create 1.5 million jobs. And just the federal government alone could bring 640,000 new cars into an electric vehicle fleet. Procurement for the federal government, you're looking at 500 billion. That's bigger than the economy of Sweden. And so if all of the procurement that's going around just in the federal government, we're not even talking about getting into sort of regulating other people, other companies or other subnational governments. We're talking about the federal government just using its purchasing power for green means. That's going to be a huge, huge leverage point. So I'm hoping to see some of that in Biden's strategy.
You know, I'm glad that you brought this up though, because I'm curious, you know, something like this seems like it'd be quite natural common sense. So it's probably gonna be quite divisive on in the legislature. So you've indicated some things having to do sort of wholly with the way the US government runs itself, vehicles and things like that. Are there any other areas where in theory, if this were to be filibustered, or you know, if they try to do it during the budget and theoretically can do it via reconciliation, but let's say some Democratic senators won't sign on to certain parts of this. If it was just Biden, what can Biden do via executive orders or actions that might get us towards some of this?
Yeah, so I like to cite other people's work. We have some ideas that we've outlined in a report that we've done at Oxford around how we could level up subnational action. But first, I want to talk about Professor Leah Stokes and Sam Ricketts have recently put out a report. Leah Stokes is kind of the queen of utility research. And she believes, and I believe as well, that a clean energy standard for the US is the single most important policy that we can pass. So if the Biden administration could just act alone with its democratically elected and democratic fellows, let's be clear that that's the majority of America speaking there, then we could have a clean energy standard, and then that could completely shift our grid, and that's the first step.
And you know, I'm thinking now that perhaps I should have led with this, but there's a lot. Obviously, we think about it in terms of what's Biden gonna do? What's the Senate gonna do? How's it gonna affect industry? All of that. For regular people in the US who might be watching this, in the next 2 years, or the next 10 years, the next 30 years, if this is the path we go down, what are some ways that might influence their lives?
It's really good. The news is really good on this point. So the Sierra Club has just put out a report called the Thrive Report that looks at the kind of job creation. I mean, let's be serious here. We're down 14 million jobs. And if we look at the green economy that's kind of already on track, the green economy has created 9.5 million jobs. And that's an outdated study. That's 2019. So I think that we could reasonably gain back all of those 14 million jobs by creating new infrastructure projects that put us on track to a green future. A couple of those examples are, you know, we need to modernize our grid. So those are long-term projects. And what I think often gets missed in this debate, the numbers are often compared to fossil fuel industry-based jobs. But those jobs are often very short-term. So you're basically comparing long-term infrastructure jobs, manufacturing jobs like electric vehicles. We could double the manufacturing industry in Detroit with electric vehicle industry improvements. But what is often that's often compared against fossil fuel jobs that go away in a year. Maybe they pay you $100,000, but they go away in a year, and that's just not a fair comparison. So green jobs are really better for long-term stability, and that's what people need right now. They're sick of instability right now.
Interesting. Well, as we pointed out, of course, you know, the hearing is ongoing. We are in this less than a month long march to Earth Day. So we're going to continue to talk about this here. But if there are people watching this that are interested in keeping up to date with this conversation, the path towards this actually becoming action, are there any sources that you would recommend for getting that information?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think you should just watch the hearing that's going on right now in the House. And I would encourage you, you know, it's great to take in information. It's great to stay informed. Get involved. Email your legislator right now and tell them to pass the Clean Futures Act. Now, if you know, if you're asking me where you should watch, I run a site called netzeroclimate.org that helps you kind of keep track of the global progress to net zero. And we're in partnership with the UN Climate Change Race to Zero campaign. So what's so exciting about this year is that we have an opportunity at the Conference of Parties that brings together nations to negotiate on climate change. We have an opportunity to set new ambition. And we really think that this is going to be the year where nations come together. But that requires people to be paying attention. And one of the best ways you can pay attention is to look and see, has your company or your city set a strong net zero target in line with the race, the global race to zero? You know, your company or your city could be ahead of the US in setting a net zero strategy. And in doing so could encourage the US to take a stand.
That's a great point. And to your point about getting involved, it might be easier to make that sort of more local action effective than, I mean, certainly push federally, but if you can get your city, you can get your state to do it, that would be helpful as well. Kaya, we really appreciate you taking time out of the hearings to join us and to break this down. Really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.